thanks for listening to the Disc Golf History and Legends podcast. Please make sure to search and subscribe to the exclusive Disc Golf History and Legends podcast in your preferred podcasting app. Welcome to Disc Golf History and Legends, sponsored by Blue Power Disc Golf. And here is your host, Scott Stokely.
Hi, everyone. So this is already blowing my mind. We've made it to episode 4 of my series of Disc Golf History and Legends. The idea behind this series, I'm probably going to have to introduce each one this way because I'm suspecting that when I do an episode about a state, probably not a lot of people outside that state are going to tune in, and hopefully everybody in the state does. But the idea here is that I want to do an in-depth history on the sport of disc golf. And in order to do that, I'm going to give every single state and every single country where they play disc golf their very own episode. I'm also going to branch off into legends and tournaments and manufacturers and all sorts of other neat stuff. But I'm super excited about this. And as this progresses, hopefully this will become the most comprehensive history of the sport out there. My ulterior motive for doing this and the idea behind starting this is that I am running 10 Blue Power disc golf events this year. And these 10 events are not like the Blue Power events I've run in the past. These are traditional PDGA sanctioned golf tournaments. You know, you come out, you know, pros are playing for 100% payback in cash, AMs 100% payback in prizes, CTPs, ace pools, you know, traditional disc golf tournaments. So come out to the Blue Power events and play a golf tournament. But in addition to that, the Blue Power part of this is that on every Saturday at the event, there's going to be an additional class, a free disc golf class for kids and adults with special needs. This means if you know anybody with autism, Down syndrome, blind, deaf, paraplegic, CP, oh, by the way, I shouldn't have said deaf, for they don't like being called special needs typically, but it doesn't matter. Everybody's invited, kid or adult, right? Come on out, and it's a free class, and every single special needs player that comes out is going to get a golf disc just for having the courage to give our game a try. So if you want to come out for the special needs, come out for that. You want to come out for the disc golf, come out just for that, or come out for both. And once again, for the fourth episode in a row, and this has to be a coincidence, but I'm doing this podcast about the history of disc golf in Oregon, and it just so happens that on July 7th and 8th, I'm running a Blue Power event in Oregon. It's going to be in Newburgh at Champoig. I'm probably pronouncing it wrong, State Park. And it's going to be super fun. Go to pdga.com or discgolfscene.com to sign up. Just a couple more quick things, and then we'll get to our guests. That's what you guys are really here for. The first thing is that Smashbox TV is the brains behind this. They're making it possible for me to just find my heroes, the people that I want to talk to and spend time with. And then I just show up and do the fun part. And Smashbox TV is doing all the work behind the scenes. So thank you to them. A second thing is that I do want to mention at these Blue Power events, I got some really cool sponsors, starting with Dynamic Discs, who has been overwhelmingly generous to the Blue Power cause, as well as Discmania and Gateway Discs, and even Zing Minis has jumped in as well. The best way to support this, to support Blue Power, number one, is to bring people to the event. Or if you hear about an event, spread the word. But the second thing you can do that helps out immensely is when you place an order for tournament discs or club discs, order from Dynamic Discs, order from Discmania or Gateway. And when you do, tell them, say, hey, we're ordering our club discs from Discmania because you're supporting Blue Power Disc Golf. And that really is what comes back the most. I don't take donations ever. All the classes are free and I don't accept donations. So supporting the people supporting me is how you can support me. Anyways, okay, enough about that. Let's get to the fun part. I need to put my headphones back on. Can we bring in our guests, Jonathan?
Hey, what's up, guys?
We have three guests. The first is on the bottom of the screen is Pop Hufty, who I first met way back in 1984 in Santa Cruz, who now lives in the Portland area. We have Stephen Wright in his car driving 70 miles an hour while he's doing this, right? Okay. I encouraged him to find a better hotspot than the one he was at. So I appreciate that. And then we have legend Jerry Miller on the phone with us as well. Hi, Jerry.
How you doing?
Good. Hey, so real quick before we get started, I want to just share a real quick story because when I left the sport in 2000, I took 13 years off and the sport was progressing every year better than the year before. But when I came back to the sport in 2014, it's like not seeing a child for a while and watching how much it had grown up. And one of the most amazing memories I have when I went back on the road in 14 was when I went to the Beaver State Fling at Milo Park. And one of the most amazingly professionally run tournaments I'd ever seen. And the courses were what we dreamed about back in the 90s when we were playing, or even the 80s. I'd never seen anything. Well, I still to this day haven't seen its equal. If you ever get a chance to get out there, it's unbelievable. But what's interesting as this applies to this podcast is that that course didn't just spontaneously pop into the ground. There were decades of work and people that went into it. And that's kind of where we're going to start, where the sport started in Oregon. One of the fun things for me is I'm ignorant. So I'm going to be asking the questions I want to know because I don't know. So I don't even know who to start with. Guys, when did Frisbee, competitive Frisbee, which is probably before the first course, I would assume, make its way to Oregon?
Miller.
Jerry, you want that one?
Sure. Started in 1980 at Rockwood Central Park. Just so happened that my mother's gate opened up into the park, and she said there was quite a commotion, so I went out there to check it out, and that's the day I discovered disc golf, well, Frisbee golf, and started playing.
And that was the first course?
It's the first course in Oregon.
Now, before the course went in, though, and I just had a player message me, there were some tournaments that were going on before that point, right?
None that I know. Go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, I seen in Oregon about 1991, and so you guys are all predating me from the Oregon standpoint in that. I remember first playing, and the courses all had the cowbells on them, and those were kind of fun because you'd go hit them and you'd hear this big old bong on the other side, and they were asking somebody put it out and hit it, and it was a while before we got to the baskets and having something to putt at that you could tell if it was in or not. And so that was the first introduction I had was all the pole holes or what do you call them? The cowbells, I guess. Right.
Cowbells.
The cowbell hole. Well, courses all over the country had their own way. The biggest challenge of the old courses was there was not, I mean, this is pre-basket. There was not a definitive way of telling whether or not a shot was or the hole was complete or not. So everybody had their own creative way of changing the materials on a certain part of a pole, for instance, so it made a different sound. So I guess that's the purpose of the cowbells.
Yeah, that was pretty much it. When you hit the metal, it made a distinctive ring as opposed to hitting the supporting post that had it. I remember when I was playing in Massachusetts a couple of times, they had made kind of this ring out of edger for the gardens that you would see. So a little tiny fence thing, but sometimes a disc would slip out of that or would bounce or who knows what. And it was a different way of putting because you kind of had to come straight down on it to have a good putt on it. But that was back in the day.
Gotcha. Hey, you know, you're going to have to forgive my, I'm still an amateur at the podcasting. Let me start with where each of you got into the sport. So Jerry said you got into it because your mom's gate opened up to the course. But what was that like back then? I mean, what Frisbees were you using? Were other people playing? Were you the only one? Or
using, go ahead, Jerry.
Midnight Flyers. And that course was put in the ground by Ed Hedrick, Tyrone Hines, and Lowell Shields. And you know, just the local guys would come out and start playing, and it just kept growing after that. Everybody inviting their friends to play.
In the community back then, I mean, Frisbee golf was really, really weird for a very long time to everybody outside the sport. I mean, how did the community respond to golf?
So, Yost, when did you start?
Can you guys hear me? Can you hear me?
Yeah. I can hear you.
Okay. Well, I started playing frisbee golf in 1985. And I got invited to a potluck, and the guy says, bring a frisbee. And we threw it these little bitty shades, little bitty, 8-inch, 8x11 tree, baby tree shades. And that was our first target. And then the next day I went home and started building courses on my own property. Played frisbee golf for about 3 years. And then I got invited to a frisbee golf tournament down at Cave Junction, Oregon. And this one feller shows up and he had a P-38 Lightning. This was 1988. And he pretty much kicked our butt with that disc. You know, we kept up with him with frisbee with our, you know, finesse shots, but he got us on the drives and everything. So I asked him, I said, where the heck do you get that thing? He says, well, I joined the PDGA. So, you know, we didn't have Google or anything. So I finally found the PDGA. They were in Memphis, Tennessee then, and joined for $15. And then had to start converting all my frisbee courses to disc courses. But, I started traveling up to Portland, really, you know, because where do you play? You know, down here in Southern Oregon, there was nothing, you know. So I'd go to Neck Portland and met Miller and all those guys. And, man, it's been a lot of years since then, too.
Hey, by the way, back in those days, when you joined the PDGA, you would call up Daryl Lynn on the telephone. And or Ted Smethers, and I'm pretty sure they would write your name and your phone number down on a scrap of paper. That was about the organization of the organization back in the early days. So what part of the state? You were in the southern part of the state, right?
Yes, sir. Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
What area?
Well, I live south of Roseburg. And Roseburg actually is pretty famous. Has the course just outside of Roseburg has Whistler's Bend. I don't know if you ever heard of that. If you ever get a chance to play it, you definitely need to. And that's been in, that went in the early 90s. We can kind of boast. We have a little course, Riverfront Park, went in 1992. And it's one of the oldest 18-hole courses in the state. Not with baskets. We had, again, wooden posts, you know, had to shoot at something. And then later on, after we got the posts in at Whistler's, we eventually started getting baskets. There's a big tournament coming up this weekend, the world's our Whistler's Bend double shootout. And, I used to run that tournament years ago and raised enough money and bought the first 6 baskets at Whistler's through that tournament. And then eventually we got baskets at Whistler's and then took the Jerry Miller's cowbells that were at Whistler's, stuck them on the wooden posts at Riverfront. So that then we had a little bit better sound than the wood, you know, we had a little bit of a, you know, a little metal sound, but heck, before that we used to shoot at anything we could, Scott and everybody, we'd shoot at ribbon trees. We'd tie mm-hmm. 2 ribbons around a tree, shoulder high, waist high. Yeah, I've shot at just about anything. Well, like all you guys, you know, light poles, garbage cans, you know. And
yeah, absolutely. So that's actually interesting. So one of the first temporary courses in Oregon wasn't even a basket course. It was cowbells.
Oh, yeah. Ribbon trees and all the parks around here. You know, we'd go to the park departments and say, hey, we'd like to put in a disc golf course. And they'd say, what? Frisbee court? No. And they wouldn't know. It'd be running against a brick wall. So we got a lot of trial periods, you know, that you can put in wooden posts for a year and see what happens. Well, you guys know as well as I do, once the roots get in, man, you're never going to pull it out. Whistler's is now has 27 holes, and it's getting pretty popular, you know.
Gotcha. Pop, we're going to bring you in a second because I know you came in a little bit later. But I want to try to get a little bit of the time frame on this. So, Jerry, are you still with us, Jerry?
I'm here.
Okay. So the first course, I apologize, the audio cut out. What was the first course again?
Rockwood Central Park.
That was in Portland?
At the time, it was unincorporated. Now it's considered Gresham.
And do you have any idea where that fits into the general history?
I'm getting a fair amount of feedback here, Scott.
I'll try to talk slower. And I hope maybe that helps. So, do you know any idea approximately what number horse in the world the first freaking horse was?
I'm really having some difficulties understanding here. Another quick brief history. There was also an Adventist school up off about a mile up the road from the Rockwood Central Park. And I don't know whether that was the second course or another camp, Camp Tadmore. I don't know which one of those two courses went in to make the second, but they were still in that same era of 1980.
Okay. And what was the, when did the first batch of course go in the southern part of the state, Stephen?
Well, we started getting baskets. We started putting them in at Whistler's first, and we actually put them in one at a time. Hole 18 went in first, and that was probably, towards the end of the late 90s. Yeah, we haven't had baskets. We were a post course for a long time. Dirt tee pads, muddy tee pads, gravel, that kind of stuff. Okay, the baskets went in a lot later.
Okay, and how did you guys fund the baskets?
We bought them all ourselves. All the players, like I say, through the Whistler's Bend double shootout, and then a lot of individuals bought them. Jerry Miller actually sponsored a hole. The Eugene Disc Golf Club sponsored a hole. Wandering J Townsend sponsored the Top of the World. Yeah, buddy. And just basically through tournaments. And like I say, the parks department down here were, without judging people, basically a bunch of rednecks, and they just, we had to do it all ourselves. And still to this day, we pretty much have to maintain the parks ourselves too. It's been a battle, but we still play, by golly.
But that's interesting though. So you had clubs in towns, disc golf clubs where there wasn't a permanent course, raising baskets at other courses. That kind of sounds like the spirit of Frisbee golf back in the old days a little bit.
Oh yeah. Well, we had a course, they were just wooden posts in the ground. The very first course before Whistler's was actually Riverfront. And I still like to say it's the second oldest 18 hole permanent public course in the state, pole course, not a basket course. It's been around a long time. And they had a volunteer fund back in the day, Roseburg City Parks, and we got enough money for the wood treated posts and a couple gallons of paint and some metal band to put around the bottom of it to show a low putt or not. And then everything was we did that park all on our own too. We had Friday flip outs, and we probably got 8 or 9 of the baskets just from a bunch of players, chipping in a couple bucks every Friday. A lot of players, because we were getting 40, 50 at a time without baskets. We definitely have love for the game. Like everybody, we throw anything,
That's beautiful. Okay. So Pop, before you came to Oregon, you were in Santa Cruz. That's where I first met you in 1984. I think I was about 13 or something, but I think there was a similar story out there. Not to digress too much away from Oregon, but world famous De La Viega did the exact same thing. You guys funded the course one basket at a time. And in fact, at a major championship, the World Cup, there was 14 posts and 4 baskets, I believe, at that time. So you can relate to that whole process, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I remember when I first came to Oregon, there was Lance Redfern and Keith Shoup and Fred Finney would travel around with 9 portable baskets to various tournaments. And these guys would show up and they would just have these baskets and say, "Hey, we're not paying the post today. We're playing with the baskets." And it was totally cool. But yeah, basically, you know, you play what you got. You know, one times we'd play lampposts. We'd play, you know, playing at UCSC, we'd play lampposts and fire hydrants. And, you know, there was a support for a tree at one place. We'd play that and all sorts of stuff. I mean, it's whatever is available mm-hmm. and whatever you can call. You know, we play safari. Hey, let's go for that big tree and, you know, go through the hole in the crotch or whatever, you know, and it's just fun. Yeah. Go out and just talk to desk. So. Did a lot of that.
And people, they like, if you weren't around then, like, it's hard to appreciate how revolutionary it was that before baskets, you never knew if a hole was complete. It was not definitive. You never knew, or you rarely knew if you got an ace because you were 200 feet away from the thing that you might've hit. It sounded like you did. In fact, I remember in Santa Cruz, all the local players knew how to make a sound that sounded just like a disc barely ticking the post. So if you weren't paying attention, So you were playing before the baskets, but when the baskets went in, it changed everything. So before we get to Oregon, what got you into disc golf before that, Bob?
Yeah. So I was playing in Boston in the 1970s, and there was this gentleman there named John Kirkland who was playing with us on the ultimate team. And we were playing, and we remember when the world-class discs came out, the 165s, the 119s, the 141s. And I remember one time he said, oh, why don't you just aim at that soda can over there? And I had this brand new disc. And I said, no way, man, I'd get it all scuffed up. And he said, well, here, try this with mine. So he let me throw one of his, and we had fun. We're just playing that one soda can. And then it was funny because, you know, a week later, he comes up to me, hey, you know, What? Let me see that. You know, let me see that disc. I threw it to him, and my disc was completely scuffed up because I'd been playing disc golf with him ever since with that. And that was a total hoot. It was just once I got over the fact that I'm going to rough up my disc. It was just fun to play, and you know, playing with the likes of Fort Felker out there and Fenn LaBaume, and you know, we used to make up courses everywhere, and by God, no matter where I live, my front porch was T1 and my backyard was hole 18, you know, and we just go play in the middle of some city somewhere in Alston, Massachusetts, we were staying, and had made up courses at MIT where I was going to school. And it was just, you know, it just caught on. It was just fun. And it was, you know, basically like you're saying, you pick a target and say, okay, that sounds good. Let's go for it. And, you know, it was back in the day when, you know, you couldn't tell if you hit it or not. And most of the time you with those discs, you couldn't throw that far anyway. So, you know, it wasn't as if you're 500 feet away, but, yeah, it was total hoot.
Okay. And so you came up to Oregon, and I'm sorry, I'm in the age group where I forget things. You came up in 1990, right?
Yeah. 91. Yeah. I came up,
91.
I came up for a job. And then I met up with Jerry and Keith and Lance and all those guys, and just started having fun with all those guys and just, you know, watching the whole thing develop. I mean, it was all, like I was saying, these guys would show up with the baskets, and I said, well, that's a good group of people to know, because, you know, if you want to go play a course and on the weekend and there's no course there, we'll just set up the baskets and we'll just make one up. And that was totally cool.
Okay.
Yeah, I came up there.
Right. So we have a bit of a time gap here between the Portland area, which the first course went in 80, and then, you know, 10 years later when the baskets started going in down south. Jerry, I hope we got you still. Are you still on?
I'm still here.
All right. So you're going to, this is up to you. Can you fill us in? I mean, during the 80s, where did the sport, I mean, how did it expand? Like, where did courses start going in during that decade?
Well, it was a pretty long, hard struggle, and eventually we got 18-hole cowbell course out at Estacada Timber Park, and then eventually that was replaced with baskets, and that was the state's first 18-hole basket course.
Okay, that was in Estacada.
Estacada.
Oh, go ahead.
Right across the river from Milo McIver. And then, but there were also other courses too, like Westmoreland and Eugene, homemade basket course in North Bend. And I'm kind of foggy as to when those actually went in. Westmoreland.
Didn't that used to be crab?
One of the oldest courses in Oregon too.
Jerry, wasn't there a course on this coast that had crab pots as the baskets?
Yeah, that's it. That's the North Bend course.
Crab pot baskets. That's the. You can do a whole show on the history of homemade baskets. So what was that? Tell me about the baskets. That's awesome.
Well, it just, you know, they work for catching crabs, so they work for catching discs too. You just kind of put in it, and if it's caught it, you're good. So it was I think they weren't multi-directional though, so you kind of had to line up your upshot to get a good putt at it.
But oh, that's totally great. Fun. Okay, so the courses started popping in around the 80s. What about tournaments? Were people running events back then, or what were those like?
I was running events.
Go ahead, Steve.
Oh, heck, I learned a lot about running events from you, Jerry. Heck, and I got to just say something real quick on the packing the baskets around. I've run a lot of ice bowls, close to 30 of them now. And I had one back in the mid-90s that we used two parks, no baskets there, no targets or nothing. We brought in portable targets. But the guys from Miller, Miller and the guys came down, brought cowbells and baskets, set up courses at two 9-hole courses, two different parks. I mean, that's the way it used to be. Those guys used to make road trips down there, and whatever golfers we had would make the tournaments up there. And as far as tournaments, we have a winter series now that's in about its 23rd consecutive year. That's pretty much our baby in Southern Oregon.
Okay. So who were the top players back then, back in the 80s?
Miller.
Yeah. You're allowed to brag.
Those days are gone.
Yeah, I
know. Lowell Shields was a good player. Lowell Shields would come down from Seattle. He was a good player.
Yeah, Lowell's awesome. So
Jeff Witt, Roland Van Bibber, Pete Foost, a lot of names, a lot of good people. Yeah, okay. A lot of good people.
What about any? Were there any women golfers back then? I mean, back then it was a little harder to find that division. But were there players in the women's division that came out?
We didn't have any down south, but you had Elena Wallman, Miller.
Yeah, and April Shields. There were, not as many as there are today. But definitely they were out there.
Okay. So this kind of gets us through the 80s. Now, two of my favorite people in the world are Bruce Sisson and Tom Embry. And it was really hard to pick who I wanted on the show. And I kind of left them out of the mix because I could choose three. But I think they were involved and some other people going into the 90s to start taking the Oregon disc golf to a level of a series of events. Is that correct? Or am I?
Oh, those guys did a heck of a job.
So what was that? Was that a state series?
Yeah. Yeah. They had the Oregon State Series, part of the Northwest Series. There's been quite a few series, Tom ran a winter series, the Oregon Liquid Environment Series. That was pretty popular for a lot of years. Really got the Willamette Valley established with a lot of players. It was a very popular tournament.
And when about did those series start? Was that a 90s thing or was it late 80s?
Yeah, I think it was more of the mid 90s. Because I met Bruce actually in 1992. I was holding my first world's biggest, I think it was everybody's first world's biggest disc golf tournament back then. And Bruce came out to my place and wasn't really sure where to go because I live kind of up in a canyon and there's gravel pits and different stuff. So he parked down below and he wasn't sure where to go. And we had one basket. It was a homemade basket, pretty funky, but it took a disc, And he started hearing that, and that's when he knew where to go. I always remember that story, Bruce. That's how he found my place, was hearing the chains and walking up the hill.
Well, here's a funny little side story about Bruce real quick is that in 1981, I was 12 years old. I just moved to a town where I didn't know anybody. And Oak Grove Park was right next to my house. And I grabbed the Frisbee, went down to the park and was out playing Frisbee by myself. And Bruce came up to me and I believe he made me a member of the club and gave me some discs. And so I kind of credit Bruce as my first real introduction to disc golf. So if Bruce is listening, hey, I'm still playing, Bruce. So I have to mention that I love Bruce and Tom. So the series starts taking off in the '90s. Is this, did it just continue a steady growth or was there a point where it kind of hit critical mass and just started to blow up?
Well, on my behalf, I'll go ahead and speak up on that. Our winter series down south has gotten so big that we had to move it to 2 days, amateur on one day and pros on the next. There's no way we could have, you know, pros and ams all on the same day. It's just too many people. We still haven't turned people away yet, but it's getting close.
Okay. And what about up north? I mean, because disc golf in Portland is blown up as big as anywhere in the world. When did Portland, like, I mean, I know it's been around for a while, but when did Portland just kind of hit critical mass?
Yeah, that's a good question. Go ahead, Jerry.
Well, I believe that it's grown steadily by about 15% every year. The only difference is now with the number of golfers that we have, 15% is quite a bit.
Okay.
Also, the advent of putting in so many courses in the local area, well, that introduces new people in those neighborhoods, which also creates growth. Yeah, it's been quite a ride, really, and only great things to happen in the future as well.
For sure.
One of the things that's happening recently, I think, is that there's been a influx of what I would call young blood that's coming over and willing to take on the responsibilities of running the tournaments. You know, there's Jeff Mitty is running the Beaver State Fling, and there's some awesome tournaments that Champouille, Dave Amon is running and Burke is running. And so I think that what's happening is that, and I love it, is that there's some new energy coming into the golf world. And, you get people like me that are put in tournaments and, you know, you get kind of beat up after a while putting in these tournaments. I'm sure Yossi, you can speak to that a little bit because sure, it's fun and you feel great doing it, but boy, it takes an awful lot out of you. And to have this new energy come into the sport, to me, it's just tremendous. I see that happening probably in the last 5 to 10 years. So I don't know, Jerry, if you've got anything to add to that, if you see anything different, but for me, it says the new blood coming in and all that energy and fixing up the courses and all that. So I think it's awesome.
Well, one thing I want to point out to all those towns that are getting to that point of having too many golfers, not enough courses, if we're growing by 15% every year, the courses need to grow by 15 just to stay even. Mm-hmm. So it's not a bad focus to have more courses, introduce more people into the game.
You know, it's such a cool thing, Jerry, to hear. You know, you've been doing this for so long, and I'm sure everyone here agrees, but you've been doing it for so long, and you're still thinking, your mind is still going, more courses that can have more players. Like, it's still like trying to grow the sport and wanting to see it grow. I think that's amazing. I mean, all you guys you still love it. So Oregon is a big state. Was there ever any like north-south rivalries, you know, at any point? I mean, was it competitive? Was it fun competitive? Or was it just kind of all viewed as Oregon?
I think we're all in for the same reason, love of the game, you know.
Not even a little bit of like wanting to go up to Portland and take their money?
Well, you want to take the money of the guy that beat you last time, but, you know.
Okay.
You know, make the side bet and all that. I mean, the thing I used to love about it is you'd go see the same bunch of people that you just love, and now you've got a different venue. Now you're playing. And one time we packed up, went to a tournament in Hawaii, and here's 30 people that you know. And, you know, you walk down the street and you go to a restaurant. Oh, yeah. Hey, how you doing, Fred? Or, you know, whatever. And so I think the thing that I like is that you're doing what you love with people that you like. And, you know, it's just you just play different places and you got different, you know, different skill sets that you need and different shots and all those different courses. So it's totally cool.
Oh, cool. I love it. What about Washington? Was there any rivalry with Washington? I mean, in other sports, that's a thing, right? I mean, when Lowell came down and took your guys' money, and I love Lowell, I've known him forever too. When Lowell came down and took your money, did it get under your skin a little bit more because he was from Washington?
Hey, I'm going to say something on that, okay? You guys, when I used to run tournaments at Whistler's back in the early 90s, we'd have about 15 pro. You guys copy?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I don't know. It's weird on my end. I don't know if I'm getting through or not. But at any rate, out of maybe 15 pro, and that was a big field, really, back in some of those days. I have the stats still. There was one where 13 of the pro players were from Washington, and Oregon only had like two or three. Roland Van Bibber, Eric Buck Smith had just moved up. He was playing pro. And actually, the only other non-Washington golfer was Mike Belchick from NorCal, who used to come. So, yeah, there was rivalry. And I don't know why some of the guys who travel further from Washington to come to Whistler's Bend than Portland. I couldn't figure it out till later, and I think it was because the Washington boys were beating them up, and they didn't like it. I'm going to say it.
That's so funny. Oh, that's fantastic. So in the 90s, who were the top players out there? I mean, who was stepping up at that point?
Oh, yeah, like say Eric Smith, Buck Smith, he was a real talented player. And once Jerry and Roland, seems like, you know, they had their day, and then, you know, we started getting older, you know, then some of that, like say some of that new blood started coming in. Gosh, I don't know. What do you think, Miller? Brody Miller, he was one hot golfer that showed up.
He's still playing, believe it or not. Yeah, just unfortunately, Scott, let me get back to the rivalry thing. It seemed a lot different in those days that we would compete with the Washingtonians and the Californians and whatnot, but the type of competition never seemed rivalry-ish or whatever. It's more like after we could get done with our rounds, we could all sit down because we were all friends and talk. Mm-hmm. So that was pretty – one of the things that I noticed that we did then that they don't do too much of now, or not as much.
Gotcha. Yeah, that's part of the goal of this podcast is, you know, I will probably say this every episode. I love where the sport is. It's has become everything I dreamed it could become, and it couldn't be better. But it was different back then, you know, and back then, you know, if I can say this in the nicest possible way, most of us were misfits. Like, I mean, people that played Frisbee back then were part of the counterculture in almost every sense. And I believe when we came together and played disc golf, we found a bunch of other people like us when maybe there weren't people like us at our jobs or at our schools. Right. I mean, would you say that would be accurate for Oregon?
Yes.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, so the rivalry was really, you know, we all had this one thing in common we all shared. But, I mean, when we were on the course, we wanted to win just as much as the kids today do. I mean, we wanted to win, hated to lose. But like you said, you know, we were friends. We were all friends.
Uh-huh. Yeah, even to the point of when the tournament's over, playing another round of 18 with big money bet, right, to play with, you know, takes back to the cooler rounds we used to do in California. And we did, you know, some of those up here. But the idea is that, you know, the tournament might be over. But we're not done yet. We you know, we're at a beautiful course. Let's play some more, you know? And so I think that, you know, that camaraderie that says, okay, look, we just want to play. And, you know, it's like I say, the tournament's done, but we're not. So, you know, to heck with the ride home, right. You know, so what? It's a couple hours. We're still playing.
And by the way, for those of you who don't know what a cooler round was, I'm going to share because what the cooler round was kind of like it sounds. You have 4, 5, 6 people per group with a gigantic ice chest full of beer. And whoever after the drive was farthest from the hole had to carry the cooler to the next tee pad. That was their penalty for a bad shot. And if you were from out of town, what you didn't realize was if you threw the worst shot, all the locals would open up the cooler and fill it full of rocks. Right? That didn't happen once. That happened every single time. This is part of our, and by the way, the cooler round was taken as serious as the tournament itself. I mean, that was very important to win the cooler round, right?
I remember one time we were playing and the Parks and Rec guys were putting on the tournament and he says, what are these guys doing? And he found out that we had more money going on in the cooler round than we had in the tournament prize money. And so he didn't get it until then. He said, well, these guys are really serious now. I said, well, yeah, there's more on the line. So yeah, it was so cool.
That's brilliant. So I don't want to, I mean, we're going to forget people, but who were some of the people that were instrumental in putting courses in and putting tournaments on back in the early days? People that, you know, we want to get their name permanently etched into this. I mean, there's obviously lots of other promoters. Like who was helping out? Who made it grow?
So we didn't mention Dan Lukacek. He put on a couple tournaments, and he had a couple tournaments at Mount Tabor Park, which was totally cool. He was helping out with a lot of that. And Roy Van Bibber, actually, I think him and Neil Snyder put in the course at Champouy, and it was funny because they originally had designed 18 holes, but the park would only let them put in 9 holes first, and then it went to 12, and then it went to 15, and then they were looking for 3 more holes, and then here comes Roy, and he says, oh, well, here's my old map that's 20 years old, and by God, those are the new 3 holes that they put in. So he had the vision a long time ago, and he was instrumental in running a lot of the tournaments too. So those are the people that come to mind for me.
Okay. What about you guys? Who else was putting in those tireless, thankless hours?
Well, Southern Oregon, actually down in the Grants Pass area, there's a fellow named Greg Guthrie who really got it. The basket courses going there. They were baskets were made out of wheels, truck wheels, which are kind of gnarly, really. But they worked. Hey, you know, we played the game. And then, J.D. Lee, Jeff Lee, he helped, and Ernie Sirimi, helped a lot with Whistlers, and a guy named Paul Denton, he doesn't play much anymore, but he used to help out a lot in the old days.
How about you, Jerry? Anybody come to mind?
Oh, we've got so many, and trying to pick out just a few, I'm going to slight some people, but Roland Van Bibber, Jeff Witt. Definitely Jay Townsend. Oh, mercy. just an enormous amount of people have grown the game. It's incredible.
Well, yeah, there's no question that, and you know, I was torn when I started doing this about even wanting to start trying to name people, because then you leave people out because so many people are involved. But I kind of decided, you know, hey, shout outs are good. But you know, you guys know who didn't get mentioned, you know, I mean, if you put the work in, you know, you put the work in, you know, the sport that everybody's enjoying today, it took people like you guys, you know, it took so many people. There was no business behind any of this. It was all love of the game and wanting the sport to grow. So Jerry, you have a shop up in Portland, right?
I do.
And you want to give us a quick shout out? You have a website you can share?
Sure, I would. Is that the clock again?
That's my clock, sorry guys.
Disc Golf Depot. We've been in business for about 36 years. I've been playing 38 years, but it wasn't until a couple years after that I figured the players needed to get their fix with their plastic. We're the largest in the Northwest. We try to serve the players the best we can. And the name of the place, I guess, Disc Golf Depot.
Okay.
And it,
All right. So if you're looking for this,
go into second generation here.
Okay. All right. So yep. Disc Golf Depot, a fantastic place to get discs. You have a physical location too, right?
Yeah, I do.
Okay. So yeah, definitely look that up when you're in the Portland area. What about you, Stephen? Are you involved in anything in the business side of the sport, or is it?
Oh, just real small scale. Yeah, I just, yeah. If I was more of like a businessman, there's all kinds of opportunity, but I'm just, you know, I'm too kicked back.
All right. What about you, Pop?
Oh, I'll have some specialty discs made up. I made up a disc for the Eclipse, and that was kind of cool. And, you know, I had a couple other discs, and, you know, when I run a couple tournaments, I'll have those made up, but, not really my primary, it's more of a weekend warrior for me rather than a full-time kind of gig.
Okay, cool. So, I really appreciate you guys so much coming on. For those of you listening, I mean, this was obviously, we're kind of jumping all over the place. I thought about making these podcasts more structured, where we kind of built a chronology and we kind of, you know, put a lot of work into it. And to be honest, that just sounded a lot less fun. So I decided that we would, we're going to bounce around a little bit, but then we're going to keep it relaxed and keep it easy for everybody. And I'm going to stick to that. I mean, that's, like I said, that's kind of more the spirit of old school Frisbee. I mean, tournaments used to start when the TD showed up. So is there anything you guys want to add? I mean, have I left anything out? Any important things for the sport of disc golf in Oregon that we would be failing if we omitted? Does this mean we're logged off?
Oh, no, we're back.
Okay.
You want to get a close-up of this.
Who can blame you? So have we left anything out? No?
No.
All right. Well, you guys, obviously this wouldn't happen without people like you guys. You guys were chosen because when I posted to the players in Oregon who I should talk to, a handful of names came up. Like I mentioned, Bruce and Tom certainly came up, but you three were mentioned. You have the respect of your peers, your idols to people like me. You guys came before me. So thank you guys so much. I hope you guys had fun, and I hope the people in Oregon enjoyed hearing just a little bit about the history of the sport in the state. But thank you guys.
Thank you, Scott.
Are we still on with Jerry and Stephen?
Jerry's still here.
I think we might have lost him. Oh, hey, you're still here, Jerry. Hey, thanks, Jerry.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
No, it was awesome. And then I guess thank you guys for tuning in, and we'll be back next week. We're going to be doing an entire episode about Washington and trash talking the golfers in Oregon, maybe. I don't know.
Looking forward to it. Yeah, you did.
Hey, but I'm going to be in Newburgh in a couple weeks, and I'm going to be in Cedro Woolley, Washington the week after. So thanks, you guys. Appreciate it. Thanks, Jonathan. Thanks, Smashbox TV, for helping out.